Greetings and welcome to Understanding Israel Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. I am this week's producer, Jeremy Roth Kushel. For this week's program, I speak with Allison Weir, author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel, and executive director of If Americans Knew, about her newly updated paper, International Campaign is Criminalizing Criticism of Israel as Anti-Semitism, hoping to further understanding Israel-Palestine beyond the walls. This is Jeremy Roth Kushel with Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. I'm very pleased today to be joined by Allison Weir. In 2000, Allison Weir left her home in California to travel alone to Palestine and Israel as an independent journalist. What she uncovered led her to feel this was one of the most significant and least understood issues for Americans today. Now executive director of If Americans Knew, Weir tirelessly studies Palestine and Israel, its history, and the U.S. connection, and travels the world speaking of her experiences and research. Thank you for joining us, Allison.
Thank you for inviting me.
Today we are going to focus on an article, more like an in-depth analytical paper that you wrote a few years ago that you continue to update, titled The International Campaign to Criminalize Criticism of Israel, subtitled For 2 decades, Israel advocates have worked to embed a new Israel-focused definition of anti-Semitism in institutions around the world, from national governments to campuses. This effort is snowballing rapidly. As a result, advocacy for Palestinian rights is on the way to being curtailed and even criminalized as quote-unquote hate. Allison, can you give us the background of how we find ourselves in both an American and international context with a new definition of anti-Semitism and how it has apparently been weaponized against the, for example, core political speech of Palestinians and their desire for their own self-determination?
I'd be glad to. I think this is extremely important, and it's been going on under the radar for quite a few years now. In fact, the article I wrote on it, we've made into a booklet. So anybody that wants to read it in hard copy, they can go to our website, ifamericansknew.org. And through that, you could contact us and get a hard copy. It's also, of course, online in the digital copy, which is a little better because that one has embedded links. What happened is a number of years ago, there were efforts to put a new definition of anti-Semitism into play in the United States, in California, where I live, and in the federal government. On lists of people working for Palestinian human rights. There was some notice of this, but nobody had looked at where this was coming from, what it really meant, and what was going on. And what's gone on, to give the overall view, and then I'll give the different steps in more detail, is that we all know what anti-Semitism is. It's bigotry. It's prejudice against Jewish people because they're Jewish, hostility because of being Jewish. It's a very clear, very simple definition of abhorrent bigotry. You can look it up in any dictionary, and it's very clear what it means. What Israel advocates have tried to do for many, many, many years is claim that anybody that speaks critically of Israel is supposedly anti-Semitic. But when you look at the definition of anti-Semitism, criticism of Israel is not in there. What has happened now is that there has been an effort to create a new, expanded definition of anti-Semitism in which Israel is very central to it. This new definition, there are a few different versions of it, but in all of them, they have a shortish definition. Then they say, here are examples of anti-Semitism. And the examples include many aspects of just honest, legitimate, factual statements about Israel, now included as being supposedly an example of anti-Semitism. So this means that if your state or your campus adopts this new definition, then the campus usually has guidelines against hate speech. So if an organization on a campus wants to bring a speaker on the issue of Israel-Palestine, and if that speaker gives factual information about Israel, then that factual information quite likely would fall under this new definition. And therefore, your group could not bring the speaker because that would be, quote, allegedly hate speech if that campus had adopted this new definition. To go back to the beginning of the definition, it really has long roots. What I discovered is that this wasn't just happening in the United States. It is part of an international campaign to create this new definition and then put it into governments, campuses, different types of organizations would all adopt this new definition. It largely began, and as we said, I even have a specific timeline of it that goes back even earlier, but I'll start with what went on in 2003. This is largely the beginning of this campaign. And not surprisingly, the person who started this campaign for this new definition was an Israeli minister named Natan Sharansky. In 2003, he started a global forum against anti-Semitism. And he said, the state of Israel has decided to take the gloves off and implement a coordinated counteroffensive against anti-Semitism. What he actually meant was a coordinated counteroffensive against criticism of Israel. So then in 2004, Sharansky, he was Israel's Minister for Diaspora Affairs. He issued a position paper that's very significant in 2004 called the 3D Test of Anti-Semitism. According to this, any statements that demonize Israel, that apply a double standard to Israel, or delegitimize Israel, are now supposedly anti-Semitic. By demonize, he means factual information about Israeli violations of human rights. A double standard means if you criticize Israel and bring up these facts, you have to at the same time criticize every other country or body that has done that. Or if you delegitimize Israel, which means that you maybe talk about its founding war, that Israel was established through a war of ethnic cleansing, as an excellent Israeli historian has documented, basically any criticism of Israel would fall into his 3D definition. So then, that same year, it's really astounding to see how coordinated this all is, because he did that in Israel. Then, in that same year, 2004, the U.S. Congress passed a law establishing a special office and envoy in the State Department to monitor anti-Semitism around the world. The State Department said there was no need for a special office to monitor anti-Semitism. They were already doing that. There was no reason for to have a whole office and envoy for that reason. But this was pushed through, and one of the people that helped push it through when they had a congressional hearing about this was, guess who? Sharansky was a witness at the congressional hearing. So that, in 2004, a new office was in the State Department. Then that new office very quickly was one of the main factors in adopting a new definition of anti-Semitism for the State Department. Now, the way that happened is interesting. It wasn't directly from Sharansky, although he was the one that endorsed and helped push through this truthfully unnecessary office. What happened in the meantime was that an organization in Europe had been created in 2005 at the behest of some Israel partisans, and I have all the names and people documented in my article. This new organization, European Monitoring Center, was against xenophobia and anti-Semitism, was established, and it issued a working definition of anti-Semitism based on Sharansky's 3Ds. So we had this working definition of anti-Semitism that was Israel-centric. Suddenly, criticism of Israel became part of anti-Semitism officially, according to that definition. So then the State Department, now that it had this new anti-Semitism office, which in every case, the people filling that office, the official envoy, has been an Israel partisan. A number of them have worked for AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobbying organization. So the very first anti-Semitism envoy endorsed the new definition. Then the next one, Hannah Rosenthal, adopted this new definition for anti-Semitism, this Israeli-centric definition of anti-Semitism. So now what should actually be called, I feel, the Hannah Rosenthal definition of anti-Semitism, or better yet, you'd probably call it the Sharansky definition. But of course, to the outside world and to the American public, it's being called the State Department definition of anti-Semitism. Once that was done, we had now the State Department supposedly endorsing this new definition, although it was really one particular individual within the State Department who managed to do that. Then I'm focusing on the U.S. aspect of this. The same type of thing was going on in England, in Europe, and in other parts. So once this was in the State Department, some campuses around the country adopted the U.S. State Department definition of anti-Semitism. This sounds very official, very benign, non-problematic, if you're not somebody that focuses on Israel-Palestine and doesn't know what this definition is. So now we had pro-Israel groups pushing this State Department definition of anti-Semitism on campuses and in state legislatures. A number of campuses have adopted this. Most campuses have guidelines against hate speech, of which anti-Semitism is considered a component. And therefore, professors, organizations, visiting speakers, materials, all could be and will be and probably are being censored because of the use of this orchestrated, brand new definition of anti-Semitism. Several years ago, the South Carolina legislature passed legislation adopting this definition and specifically connecting it to campuses in South Carolina. I did an article about that event, and I talked to a few of the legislators in South Carolina. Most of the legislature wasn't really paying any attention to this. It seemed like a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And even these legislators who were opposing it, who understood that this would be a violation of the First Amendment, of free speech, of open academic inquiry, even they didn't realize how important this was. I remember talking to a few of them. These were very intelligent people, but they're focused on their state, of course, their state legislators. That's very appropriate. And they were surprised when I told them that what was going on in their state legislature in South Carolina was headlines in the Israeli media, because in passing this would be very significant for Israel. This would prevent Americans from learning the full facts on Israel-Palestine. And by preventing Americans from learning that, it means that we won't learn that we give Israel over $10 million per day. It means that also we won't know about the daily human rights abuses that are going on in Israel every day. They're not covered in our media. Only rarely do we hear any of these things. And even when we hear about them in the mainstream media, it's usually with some Israel spin. This has all been an extremely important phenomenon that's been going on now since 2003. I had a timeline at the end of my article that I've been adding to. Every year there's an update. For a while, every few months, there was another update. Slovakia would adopt this. Dutch lawmakers would adopt it. The Labor Party, World Jewish Congress, called for everybody to adopt this. Portugal adopted the definition. Efforts were going on in Canada, Italy. It just goes on and on.
As you've pointed out, this is not just a political phenomenon based around the United States, although that's a key locus as everyone paying attention to the geopolitics of the special relationship between the United States and Israel knows. Can we hone in terms of the political implications of weaponizing the definition of anti-Semitism by focusing on some political facts surrounding some of these key figures who are leading the way on this? For example, you mentioned Natan Sharansky as this key figure, and that he was there in the U.S. Congress testifying in 2004. The timing of that is very interesting. It's the year after the launch of the Iraq War, which anybody who's read The Israel Lobby by Mearsheimer and Walt, Chapter 8, knows how instrumental the Israel Lobby in total was in terms of the politics of all of that. Eventual and prior Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in the U.S. Congress in 2002 as one of the more strident advocates for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And then meanwhile, Sharansky is not only the godfather of the quote-unquote new anti-Semitism, of the abuse, really, of anti-Semitism. And I should point out that in the wake of the latest round of Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people, most especially in Gaza, Sharansky went out of his way to write an article to accuse Jews who are against Israeli politics and Israel as an ethnostate, as I myself am, as a Jewish American. He called us un-Jews. As you actually end up pointing out in your article, Allison, utilizing anti-Semitism in this way and linking it to specific historical state power politics is anti-Semitism in a way. It's always said that anti-Semitism in terms of being critical of Israel is being against Jewish self-determination. I believe that as a Jew, I have the right to political self-determination all the way to a spiritual way to morally oppose actions by a state that says to be acting in my name, that claims to be an ethno-state of the totality of Jewish people and dominating, oppressing, abusing, and killing Palestinian indigenous people. And meanwhile, Sharansky is not only the godfather of this modern weaponization of the new anti-Semitism, but he also wrote the book that George W. Bush then marketed as the reason for the Iraq War and the destabilization of the greater Middle East, titled The Case for Democracy, The Power of Freedom to Overcome Tyranny and Terror. So that's one piece of this core political question surrounding some of the characters who are leading the way in this that calls into question whether we could even actually criticize them politically without being called anti-Semites, self-hating Jews, maybe in my case. And then maybe we could move back to the question of why this might be of critical interest to all the American people who truly value their freedom of conscience, their freedom of speech.
It's very important because this is incremental change. That's why it can keep going on and keep staying beneath the radar. It's not yet illegal to criticize Israel, but by making it allegedly hate speech, it gets closer and closer to becoming a crime. The kind of discussion you and I are having could down the road be considered criminal action, and there could be criminal penalties. We're not there yet. But that's the direction this is headed. In these cases, what's happening, once there's this new definition, then it's not yet a crime, but law enforcement then uses it to evaluate actions. This is getting very close to criminalizing it. Law enforcement in this country and in other places specifically will adopt this definition to use in evaluating whether somebody is a criminal and whether they have committed a crime of some sort.
To this day, on that point, although I have not seen my own police record, based upon sworn depositions by supervisorial staff in the Kansas City Police Department who were responsible for overseeing such things as the tagging of alleged crimes with the anti-Jewish hate definition, I apparently still have an anti-Jewish bias code tagged on my police record for being arrested while in the middle of core political speech as a self-identified Jewish American at a public event at the Kansas City Public Library with a former diplomat to Israel, American diplomat to Israel, Dennis Ross, who's been titled by even his own fellow diplomatic corps in the U.S. government as Israel's lawyer. And meanwhile, I had a Gentile Kansas City police detective go along with the Jewish Federation security director in the Kansas City area in grabbing and arresting me and then ultimately charging me for core political speech that spoke against terrorism, that spoke in an ethical fashion about when are we as Jews and Americans going to stand up in an ethical fashion in relationship to historical facts about such things as Zionist terrorist acts by the Stern Gang, where they sent letter bombs to then President Truman in the year before he recognized Israel, my own investigations and assertions about some of the origins of the war on terror in September 11th, and then the blatant historical facts of the King David Hotel bombing being Zionist terrorism that included not only the death of all kinds of British citizens, but also Jews amongst them. And this detective who was paid to go train in Israel 6 months prior to this incident insisted on having this anti-Jewish tag against me included against the better judgment of his own superiors who knew the actual law better. And so this actually points, I think, to what you are alerting us to about where this could head. And although you point out that it is not yet a definitional crime to criticize Israel, it has also become part of the larger push by the Israel lobby in the United States of America to make it more difficult to publicly criticize Israel. For example, all of these anti-boycott, divestment, sanction laws around the country. Even here in Kansas, where I live, we had a Mennonite math teacher of conscience who had to fight the state of Kansas with the help of the ACLU in order to push back a law that would have not allowed her to teach math as she had for many years because she had a moral and religious conscience in solidarity with the Palestinian people and stood for the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against the Israeli state. And so when you combine that with what you talked about in terms of the pressure on American campuses, you begin to understand that there's a growing core political pressure applied against the American people of all backgrounds. And so as we finish up, will you point to these very specific institutional factors in terms of the American context, such as AIPAC, for example? You point out in your article, The International Campaign to Criminalize Criticism of Israel, that an AIPAC official announced at the 2010 convention, quote, "We're going to make certain that pro-Israel students take over the student government. That is how AIPAC operates in our nation's capital. This is how AIPAC must operate on our nation's campuses," unquote. And then you point out that the Anti-Defamation League, who has a background as a very clear Israeli partisan, it is also, as pointed out by prior guests of this show, Jeffrey Blankfort, a proven track record of spying on American civil society, even including at that point against American citizens who were against the apartheid government in South Africa. And then you point out that even the definitional scope of quote-unquote anti-Semitic incidents has been hyped up by the Anti-Defamation League by including this series of threats against Jewish communities around the United States and North America and actually around the world by what turned out to be an accused Israeli young man, Michael Kadar, and how this has continued to be included in their assertions of the rise of anti-Semitic incidents. Can you tell us about the institutional powers and factors that have not only brought us to this moment, but also represent some of the potential threats against civil society and core political speech more generally?
The pro-Israel lobby in the United States is basically what has pushed this. And it's very, very significant. Before I became aware of the Palestinian issue, I really wasn't aware of the Israel lobby, even though just one component, AIPAC, is considered by Forbes magazine, I think it was, the second most powerful lobbying group in Congress. And yet many people had not heard of AIPAC at that time, and even still may not have heard of it. And AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is just one of hundreds of organizations in the United States that advocate for Israel. The Jewish Community Relations Centers, many cities around the country, if you look on their website, specifically advocate for Israel and push this type of definition. The Jewish Federations that are in pretty much every state, you look on their website, they're Israel advocacy organizations. The ADL, as you point out, is very important. Most of us think of it as a benign, anti-bigotry organization. I believe that most Americans oppose bigotry of all kinds. What many people don't realize is that half of its mission officially, and I expect more than half of its activities by the ADL, are actually concerned with Israel. As you say, when it put out its report about this huge amount of anti-Semitism, it was including, I believe, 2,000 fake bomb threats by this young Israeli man who was calling them in around the country. It came out who was doing it. This was not anti-Semitism. And yet the ADL continued using it in its list. I think that the ADL considers criticism, actions regarding Israel-Palestine, they often list as anti-Semitism, And yet the media consistently headline, ADL finds rising anti-Semitism. I've never seen a headline, ADL finds less anti-Semitism. I've just never seen that headline. Although often when you read it, if you find out the number of anti-Semitic assaults are often, fortunately, very low. So I would be very suspicious of what this rising anti-Semitism is that the ADL continues to claim. Now, 2 points I'd like to make. For all Americans, whether or not Palestine is far away, it's on the other side of the world, it's out of sight, out of mind, we have a great deal of difficulties here. Many people are struggling to make a living, especially with COVID going on. So it's hard necessarily to pay attention to be concerned about something so far away. But this is definitely having an impact on our universities, on our rights, on our freedom of speech. It's also having an impact on the many Americans who have gone to fight wars in Iraq, for example, largely on behalf of Israel. Right now, Dennis Ross, as you point out, he's been called Israel's lawyer quite accurately, even by close colleagues. I think Condoleezza Rice once interrupted him, telling him if I wanted an Israel Likud position, I would ask for it. That's what he was giving her. So here we have Dennis Ross and others. Now we're finally out of Afghanistan, or at least getting out of Afghanistan, 19 years later than we should have done so. President after president actually tried to do that. Now Israel partisans are trying to use this as a way to push us into an attack on Iran, another of Israel's perceived enemies. This would be another devastating failed war if the United States ends up doing it as we did with Iraq. This new anti-Semitism definition is a key component that prevents us from having the information that we need to have. And the Israel lobby uses our lack of information on Palestine and on Israel itself to push us into attacks on countries that Israel perceives as its enemies. We were pushed into attacking Iraq. That was a devastating, tragic war. It led to the rise of ISIS. It destroyed Iraq. It cost thousands of American lives, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives. It caused destabilization of the whole region. It caused immigrants to leave and go elsewhere. It was a devastating, tragic, failed war. Now Israel partisans are trying to get the U.S. to attack Iran. We have now attacked it economically, and we've done some military actions. But they may ask for even more if this continues because of Americans' lack of information on Israel, because of the censorship that was being achieved through this new definition. Then we may go into another war that will be another failed, tragic, devastating war in the Middle East.
This is Jeremy Roth-Gushel with Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. I've been speaking with Allison Weir, the author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel, and the executive director of If Americans Knew. Allison, will you let our audience know where they can find out more about you and your work?
Yes, thank you very much. They can go to ifamericansknew.org, ifamericansknew. You'll find that article that I was discussing, the new definition that's now become the IHRA definition is the latest form of it, and many statistics about the current situation in Israel-Palestine.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.